This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What started in Wuhan has returned to Wuhan. The Delta variant is now in China. Case numbers are low, but Chinese authorities are clamping down hard on travel.
You will notice that there is nobody here. That's the security line. They've got one security line open up and like six people working.
Also today in Haiti, the investigation to find the president's killers continues to be slow. Many are skeptical that justice will be served.
Things that, you know, that don't happen in an investigation that is really trying to get at the truth have happened repeatedly.
And in Tokyo, the crowd is not going wild because there isn't one.
That's not what we normally get, right? We get coaches, we get family, we get friends, we get media that's just going crazy.
How relative silence impacts elite athletes. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We start today in Afghanistan. Yesterday in Kabul, there was an attack outside the home of the defense minister. He was not hurt, but the attack represents a major breach of security in the heart of the capital city. The Taliban claimed responsibility. Elsewhere in Afghanistan, the Taliban has launched intense attacks against government security forces, including in the city of Herat in the western part of the country. The World's Shirin Jafari is just back from Afghanistan. And Shirin, you notably spent a few days in Herat last week. The Taliban has not fought against government forces in this part of the country for many years, as I understand. So this is a big deal that this happened in Herat. What did you see?
Herat is the third largest city in Afghanistan. It's not far from the border with Iran. And the city has long been an economic hub. And right now, Herat is essentially surrounded by Taliban-controlled territory. In fact, the Taliban hold an important border crossing with Iran. Also, Herat is a city with a long history of resistance against the Taliban going back many years. So I was curious. I went there to get a sense of what's happening, but also to hear from people at a moment when the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan and the Taliban is advancing. On a drive through the city, street vendors are selling fresh food on the side of the road. Heaps of red figs, melons, and Herat's famous grapes, the jewel of Herat, as they're called, because of their golden color and sweetness. Humayun is a Herati, a local born and raised here. He's got jet black hair and wears a traditional shirt and pants. He's showing me around the city, and as we drive, he points towards a hill. When the Americans came in 2001, he says, they bombed this area. Some Taliban were living here, but it was also home to people like me and my family, Afghans who had no connection with the Taliban. But we were still caught up in the middle of a bloody war, Humayun tells me. He was 8 years old at the time. For 6 months, he says, the Americans bombed the area. A lot of people died. Humayun says he fled with his family to a nearby village. When they came back a year later, they found their home destroyed. But they rebuilt. Slowly, life went back to normal. Shops and schools reopened, he says. Today, 2 decades later, Humayun owns a wedding hall. Business is good, he says, and he's even thinking about marrying the girl of his dreams. But this is Afghanistan, he says, a country where people never seem to get a break from war. As Humayun and I discuss his hopes and dreams for the future, we pull up to a military checkpoint. Khand Agha, a 23-year-old soldier with the Afghan security forces, agrees to speak with me. He says he's been manning this checkpoint on the outskirts of the city for the past month. He covers his face with a black and white scarf and a pair of Oakley-style sunglasses. It's partly to hide his identity, partly to shield it from the fierce wind. The Taliban are not far from here, Khand Agha tells me, so he and his men are getting ready for a fight. An excavator is digging trenches into the earth behind him as we talk. Checkpoints like these are buffers between the Taliban and the big urban areas, like Herat. The militants have been taking territory surrounding most major cities in Afghanistan, but they've mostly stopped short of attacking city centers. That's in accordance with the agreement the Taliban signed with the US 2 years ago. But now this is changing. Only a few hours after my conversation with the soldier, Khand Agha, that same checkpoint came under fire. On Thursday, Taliban fighters launched an offensive against Herat. They attacked a bridge that connects the city to the airport. All flights were cancelled. Herat suddenly felt like a city under siege. News of the Taliban attacks put residents on edge. Hamid Sultani is the owner of an antique shop. He says he hates the idea of the Taliban taking over. If they do, he would have to shut down his business. No tourists would come to visit here if the Taliban are in control, he says. Herat is an ancient city with numerous historic sites to see. Until recently, Sultani says, he had enough visitors to stay in business. Now he's thinking about closing the shop and opening a restaurant. Maybe that would be more acceptable to the Taliban, rather than a business dealing with art and history, he says. Intense fighting in and around Herat continued through the weekend, but Afghan security forces claimed to be beating back the Taliban advance. Flights resumed out of the city on Sunday afternoon. On the drive to the airport, we passed the same checkpoint where the young soldier, Khand Agha, was posted. He was nowhere to be seen. The place was deserted. And there were clear signs that a gun battle had taken place.
The World's Shirin Jafari there, reporting from Herat in western Afghanistan. Shirin, we're going to hear more reporting from you about Herat this week. Tell us a bit more.
I spoke with some women in Herat about how they're doing right now and about their concerns. I met some women who were recently displaced. They fled their homes after the Taliban took over areas in western Afghanistan. I also spoke with some young students who are part of Afghanistan's robotics team. They study at the university in Herat, and they shared with me how they see their future now that the U.S. is leaving the country. We'll hear more about that on Friday.
Really looking forward to those stories, Shirin. The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you, and welcome back.
Thanks so much.
China has been successful keeping the coronavirus in check, but now the Delta variant is changing all that. China is reporting more than 500 COVID cases across 36 cities. For a nation of 1.4 billion people, 500 cases plus is still a really low number. But there's growing concern that things will get worse. It's summer vacation season in China, and people are on the move, which means viruses could also be on the move. The World's Rebecca Canther is on the line with me from Shanghai. Let's talk about Wuhan, where the pandemic began. The government is testing people there again now, right? What's going on?
So remember, Wuhan is in central China. It's about a city of about 11 million people. You know, when we say outbreak in China, just keep in mind there are only 7 cases reported in Wuhan. All of them are from people who traveled from other places in China, like Nanjing, where the major outbreak is. But officials here are taking this very seriously. They've said the entire city must be tested. I spoke with Sarah Plato. She's a university researcher in Wuhan, and she and her son lined up to get tested yesterday.
They chop immediately. Like, they didn't close all Wuhan. They closed my area, 2 million people, you know, in my sub-district. The shops are open, so you can still go out and buy things. But, you know, people are afraid, so they stay in.
And it's not just Wuhan. There are restrictions in many cities now in China. And a lot of flights and trains across the country are halted or being restricted right now.
2 million people in one district of Wuhan, you really get the sense of scale and the risk. If this is travel season, Rebecca, what does that mean for Chinese people who usually take time in the summer to go visit family or take a vacation?
So just scanning through my social media, I noticed people were talking about their situation. Some of them went on a trip, traveled through a place where there are some cases, so they're stuck in quarantine, or the place they went to has restrictions put in place, so now they're stuck, they can't go home. I talked to this American teacher named Zach Cuban. He had to quarantine in the city of Nanjing, where the main outbreak was, and there are more than 200 cases there. And he told me he was finally able to leave the city today after taking 8 COVID tests. And this is a video he sent me from the train station.
This is the Nanjing South train station. During COVID, you will notice that there is nobody here. That's the security line. They've got one security line open up.
He told me he saw only a few other people on the train, which is very unusual in China.
How did China get here, Rebecca, after doing so well fighting the coronavirus?
Well, yeah, people here are asking the same question. People thought, okay, this is under control. City officials in Nanjing speculated that the cases there came after sanitation workers cleaned a plane coming in from outside of China. It's really hard to say. In any case, the vaccination rate in China is now more than 60%. There are several vaccines in use here for adults. Two of them, Sinopharm and Sinovac, were recently approved for kids 3 to 17. So the government thinks that maybe by the end of the year, 78% of the population will be vaccinated.
Finally, Rebecca, if more restrictions are being put in place and the summer travel season is disrupted, what does this all mean for China economically?
I mean, a lot of people are canceling their vacation plans for fear of not being able to get back home in time for school to start, including me. So I called up the guest house in Western Yunnan province where I was supposed to go this weekend, and I asked the owner how she's coping. What she's saying is, usually summer is the busiest time of year, so she should be booked 80%, but this year she's only booked 10%, and there's no bookings for August. And she says that's true for all the hotels and guest houses in her area, even though they're 300 miles away from any cases. This upsurge in COVID cases, it's not centered in one part of China, but all over this time. And the government is basically urging people to stay home, not to travel unless it's absolutely necessary.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai with the latest news on the spread of the Delta variant. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we'll hear how Sinovac, the Chinese vaccine Rebecca just mentioned, is raising questions and even sparking anger in Southeast Asia. It is time for our Olympic interlude. Park skateboarding made a memorable debut in Tokyo last night. One by one, 20 skaters from 6 continents dropped into the bowl. The women's event drew some of the youngest competitors in Olympic history, most of them under 20. The teens from Japan cleaned up. 19-year-old Sakura Yosozumi won gold after nailing this impressive run.
There you go, ollie 540, okay. And the melon grab, backside 5 to finish it.
If you know nothing about skateboarding, just remember that an ollie 540 and the melon grab, that is a big deal, as in, don't try this at home kind of stuff. Yosozumi's tricks made it tough for any of the other competitors to catch her. 12-year-old Kokono Hiraki of Japan did come close and landed the silver. The host country has dominated skateboarding at the Games. They've won 5 of the 9 skateboarding medals so far, including all 3 golds. Gold medalist Sakura Yosozumi said when Japanese skateboarders found out their Olympics would have the first skate competition, it inspired them to train hard. British skateboard phenom Sky Brown has ties to Japan. She was born there and mostly grew up in Miyazaki, on the southern tip of the island. Brown went into the competition favored to win gold and got bronze. After her run, she was emotional.
It's insane to be here. I'm so happy to be on the podium with these guys. They are so amazing. I mean, everyone ripped. I'm honestly just happy to be in Tokyo, but getting on the podium is insane.
Sky Brown ripping it up at the Olympics at the age of 13, the youngest Brit ever to medal at the Summer Games. Tonight in the men's park event, you'll only see a few teen skaters, plus 2 veterans of the sport, Denmark's Rune Glifberg and South Africa's Dallas Oberholzer, both 46, making them 2 of the oldest Olympians in Tokyo. Neither man expect a medal. Oberholzer said he's just glad to finally prove to his mom that skateboarding has not been a giant waste of time. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's been nearly a month since the assassination of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse. Police have detained more than 40 people, but the rule of law is being tested in Haiti, and so far, it's running into some brick walls. That's according to our next guest, attorney Brian Concannon. He founded the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's also assisted the Haitian government in the past in investigating several other high-profile killings. Brian, how is this investigation into the slaying of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse going so far? Where are we at?
There are a lot of concerns about the investigation. There are judges who said they were kept away from the crime scene. There's been evidence that has been destroyed. There are judges and clerks who are in hiding because they've been intimidated. And there are lots of pieces of information that people think should have been very important, especially video footage from security cameras that has not been shown publicly, at least.
So let's take that apart. I mean, the judges and clerks in Haiti who are trying to get to the bottom of this killing, they're running a risk doing that? What kind of threats are they facing?
Death threats. And that is particularly compelling in light of the fact that the president was assassinated a few weeks ago. Just about a year ago, the head of the Bar Association, the lawyers group, was assassinated. His crime was never solved.
Some basic forensic stuff is not getting done. You alluded to that. Investigators haven't been able to even get access to the surveillance camera footage that was rolling at the crime scene during the assassination. Why is that? And what other fundamentals to any investigation are not getting done?
It's a good question why people didn't get access. There were justices of the peace who said the police just wouldn't let them in for several hours after the murder. There's also been evidence destroyed. The cars that many of the alleged attackers were in were burnt. Bodies were moved, and things that, you know, that don't happen in an investigation that is really trying to get at the truth have happened repeatedly in this case. There's also controversy about who is running it. It's mostly run now by police and the prosecutors, and Haitian human rights groups, as well as judges, have been saying, no, this is something that should have been transferred to an investigating judge who's leading the case and can work with prosecutors and police, but it's better to have an investigating judge managing the case. And one recent concern is this week, the prosecutor issued a bunch of warrants, arrest warrants, against fairly prominent religious and political figures. And this opens accusations that this is being done against political opponents rather than against people who really are answerable for this crime.
Brian, as I mentioned, you've been involved in the investigation of several other politically motivated assassinations in Haiti in recent years. What lessons do you take away from those experiences that could help this investigation?
There are short-term lessons, like the facts that you need to have a credible person, preferably a judge, running the investigation. You need to have technical capacity. But there's a much bigger lesson to me, and that is one of political will. In one prosecution I worked on, we went to trial in the year 2000. We effectively convicted top military and paramilitary leaders in a trial that was hailed as fair to both defendants and victims alike. But that was done because there was a government that was behind the prosecutions and really wanted to get justice.
So from the legal community in Haiti, what are you hearing? Are they looking for more assistance from the U.S. and the international community or less?
They're actually looking for both. I think that where they think the international community can help is doing things like providing technical assistance. And the FBI is working with Haitian authorities. Most of the people that I talk to think that is a positive step. But what Haitians across the political spectrum want less of is less U.S. interference in Haiti's broader politics. Most Haitians believe that the current PHTK party is only able to maintain power because it has the support of the U.S. government. And they've been asking the U.S. government to stop propping up the PHTK party, allow a Haitian-led solution to emerge that will lead to a credible government that can do this investigation and run fair elections.
Attorney Brian Concannon is the founder of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's been speaking with us about the investigation into the July assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Thank you very much, Brian.
Well, thank you, Marco.
Here's another one to add to the growing list of things that climate change is threatening: emperor penguins. These are the big guys who make their home down in Antarctica. As the name implies, it is the biggest penguin species. Adults stand about 4 feet tall. A new study says if global warming continues at its current rate, more than 80% of emperor penguin colonies will be gone in the next 80 years. In response, U.S. federal wildlife officials are proposing to list the animals under the Endangered Species Act. Joining us to discuss is Phil Trathan with the British Antarctic Survey, who co-authored the new study. What are the main ways that climate change threatens emperor penguins, Phil? Are you already seeing the effects?
Emperor penguins breed through the Antarctic winter, and they need sea ice as a stable platform. So they really depend upon the sea freezing and forming a firm base. And as temperatures increase in the Antarctic, then we will see the sea ice disappear. And that means then that emperors will have no place to breed.
How crucial are emperor penguin populations to the Antarctic ecosystem? And what would happen to that ecosystem if those populations do collapse?
If we do start seeing the sea ice decline, as all the models predict, and if we see emperors decline, then they will go. And along with that, there's going to be impacts on the whole food web. So emperor penguins feed on Antarctic silverfish, on Antarctic krill, and on a number of squid species. So some of those will also be impacted. They're the canary in the coal mine that's going to tell us about the Antarctic ecosystem.
It is a whole food cycle, isn't it? In response to your study, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to add these animals to the U.S. Endangered Species List. There are no wild emperor penguins, of course, that live in the U.S. Are you aware of any other countries considering similar measures to try to protect penguins from afar?
Yeah. So, Marco, the Antarctic Treaty is currently considering listing the emperor penguin as an Antarctic specially protected species. And that would mean that the countries that are signatory to the Antarctic Treaty would also have goals of trying to protect them. And that's a much greater number of nation states than just the US. The listing by the US on the Endangered Species Act is great. It's a good lead for other nations. So I think that the US should be proud in that respect.
So clearly a lot of nations see the value and importance of keeping the special animals from extinction. You've been to the Antarctic 20 times. You have had a lot of face-to-face time with emperor penguins. What would you say is different or special about this animal?
So emperors breed in the winter, so they huddle together to stay warm, to keep their bodies warm and to make sure that their eggs are warm. Unlike other penguins, emperors in that respect are quite cool. They're not aggressive. They're just so calm in the way that they deal with an environment, which to humans is just really harsh. Mm. I mean, we wouldn't survive in temperatures that the emperors survive in. I've been on the ice with emperor penguins. You can hear them calling. You can hear them calling to their chicks. It's so magical. I mean, I wish your listeners could actually go down there and listen and see these things for themselves.
It sounds amazing. Phil Trathan is a research scientist with the British Antarctic Survey, speaking with us from Cambridge, England. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. A year ago today, a blast tore through the port of Beirut. People there are still waiting for accountability. Hope is fading fast.
Because all the government are guilty. So someone who's guilty can't find the truth.
Also ahead, how the empty stands in Tokyo are affecting athletes. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been a few weeks since we reported on the violent situation in the Tigray region in northern Ethiopia. At one point in recent months, it seemed the conflict between Tigrayan rebels and the Ethiopian government was winding down. But in fact, reports from the ground suggest that troubles are not over. This week, close to 50 bodies were found floating in a river that marks the border between Sudan and Tigray. The bodies had gunshot wounds. Many had their hands bound. This is all happening as the Ethiopian government has suspended some aid organizations from operating in the region. William Davison focuses on Ethiopia with the Crisis Group and joins us from London. William, what can you tell us about the scene on the ground in Tigray right now?
The scene on the ground in Tigray has changed quite a lot over the last few weeks, because at the end of June, we had the withdrawal of the federal forces from most of Tigray and the withdrawal of the sort of federally appointed interim administrators. So this was a very dramatic shift, and the sort of ousted Tigray regional leaders, they have taken back control of most of Tigray region. But subsequent to that, we have seen federal restrictions on the access for humanitarians to Tigray and also interruption to very basic services like telecoms and electricity.
So those bodies, what do you know about what happened to them?
Well, I think it's very hard to say at this stage definitively or with any real authority what happened. Your listeners have heard that the bodies have been found, but we don't know, of course, when the people were killed. We don't know much about their origin, and we don't know much about the perpetrators. But you know, suffice to say, there has been allegations from activists for the Tigrayan cause that these were Tigrayan civilians murdered by Amhara militias who operate in that part of Western Tigray. But they are in control. But of course, this is also disputed by the other side. So really, it's a case of waiting to see what further information comes out about that.
I see reaction from the Ethiopian government. They say the pictures of these bodies are fakes. Why would they say that?
Because this has been a brutal propaganda war as well as a brutal real war. It's hard to name a single incident where there are not, you know, something like completely opposite interpretations or versions of what has occurred.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find a hopeful narrative here with the fighting in Tigray. What does this all suggest about where the conflict is headed?
Very significant developments on the battlefield, but in many ways, it hasn't resolved the core political disputes. One of the core reasons for that is the federal blockade. Tigrayan forces say they are on the offensive to get round the blockade. You know, the federal government says, well, we're not removing the blockade because the Tigrayan forces are the aggressors here. There was also a massive problem in Western Tigray. That is the region that Amhara regional forces and administrators have taken over and claimed as rightfully Amhara regional territory. They are still in control of that large swathe of land, which is adjacent to Sudan. And the Tigrayan forces and leaders are intent on taking back that land from Amhara control. So that is a massive obstacle to a ceasefire here.
So with the Ethiopian government suspending the Norwegian Refugee Council and Doctors Without Borders from conducting aid operations in Tigray, help us understand why would they do that, and what do you think that means for the overall relief effort?
As the Tigrayan forces have become resurgent and as there has been increasing reporting of human rights abuses and a humanitarian crisis inside Tigray, that has led to increasing allegations and perception in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia more generally, including amongst the officials, that Western entities are cooperating and actively supporting the Tigrayan forces. I think those are very overblown claims, and it is, you know, simply product of this conflict situation that those agencies are committed to providing humanitarian relief. They want to do so in all areas. And so when they push to get access to rebel-held areas, the government or actors connected to the government might perceive that as offering support to those opposing forces. You know, as the federal operation has faced such massive problems in Tigray, that has led to increasing allegations that the international community, including humanitarian actors, are to blame. I think it's on the back of that that we've seen these actions against specific agencies.
William Davison is a senior analyst with the Crisis Group focused on Ethiopia. He's in London. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
The World Health Organization is calling for a moratorium on COVID vaccine boosters for a couple of months. And that's because health officials want to make sure more people worldwide get their first shots. For large parts of the globe, the vaccines they're receiving are made in China from a company called Sinovac. China's government has sent more than 1 billion doses of the Sinovac shot around the world, often for free. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, there's a growing sense in Southeast Asia that this particular vaccine is not up to snuff.
It was a huge PR victory for China. Joko Widodo, president of Indonesia, leader of the fourth largest country in the world, getting vaccinated, and he went with Sinovac. He was grinning and laughing as the needle went in and the cameras popped. The photo op seemed to say, Sinovac, good enough for Asia's top leaders, good enough for everyone. Well, that was in January. Now Indonesia is the world's epicenter for new COVID cases. Graveyards are filling up. The government is fighting back with vaccines, and almost all of them are Sinovac, which is now getting bad PR. Because some doctors in Indonesia fully vaccinated with Sinovac are getting COVID anyway, including a woman named Novilia Bakhtiar, the lead doctor overseeing Sinovac research in her country.
Kalau kita lihat virus-virus yang bermutasi.
That's a video of her giving an online presentation to colleagues in late May. 6 weeks later, she was dead from COVID. Sinovac did not save her. And that worried people all over Asia, because Indonesia is far from the only country locked into using Sinovac. And at this point, people will just need to accept it, says Diki Budiman, a prominent Indonesian epidemiologist.
Not many countries has the privilege to have access to the most effective vaccine.
The most effective vaccines being Pfizer or Moderna. Budiman says they do seem stronger than Sinovac at fighting the Delta strain, which is ravaging Southeast Asia. And governments are now shifting gears. Malaysia says it will stop buying Sinovac. Indonesia wants to give its health workers an extra booster shot of Moderna. Thailand is saying the same thing. And in the capital of Bangkok, the public is angry. That's a clip from social media from 2 weeks ago. Bangkok police clashing with protesters who say officials put too much faith in this Chinese vaccine. But is this backlash against Sinovac fair? Not entirely. Diki Budiman, the epidemiologist, says the Chinese vaccine is still really good at keeping people out of the hospital. All the doctors who received Sinovac and still got sick or even died, that's less than 1% of those who got the shots. And waiting for better vaccines to come along, he says, is not an option.
We cannot wait. We have to use the current weapon that we have.
The weapon they have is Sinovac. It's the most prevalent vaccine in the world, used in more than 80 countries. 50 got it from China for free. People say they want Pfizer, but that vaccine has to be kept in special coolers at minus 70 Celsius, colder than the average night at the South Pole. Good luck getting that to remote towns in the Asian tropics. Budiman says the logistics just aren't there. Meanwhile, Sinovac can be kept in a regular fridge. So Diki Budiman says to his fellow Southeast Asians, don't dismiss Sinovac. If you get the Delta variant, it'll probably save your life.
Even when they got COVID-19, they just show the mild symptom, very mild symptom.
In Southeast Asia, COVID deaths are up. Almost everyone who's dying was never vaccinated at all. Still, the economy's hurting, people are angry, and Sinovac is soaking up a lot of blame. But Budiman says the real problem isn't Sinovac. It's that while wealthier countries are flush with vaccines, not-so-wealthy nations are desperate for any type of vaccines, and they just aren't coming fast enough. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
It's a moment that elite athletes dream about, competing at the Olympics, the crowd screaming their name, jumping into the stands of spectators when there's a victory. Except, of course, at this Olympics in Tokyo. Because of the pandemic, there are no fans in attendance and no family members to hug after you're done competing. You gotta FaceTime them instead. For many athletes used to feeding off the energy of a crowd, that can be a big adjustment. Our next guest is dialed into this. Adam Naylor is a sports psychology consultant who has worked with athletes at the collegiate, professional, and Olympic levels. Adam, athletes found out around 2 weeks before the Olympics began that there would not be spectators allowed at the Games. What does not having spectators and fans there, cheering them on, what does that do to their performance?
So we do know if we perceive the energy and the crowd around us in the right way, it definitely gives us a bump and a nudge. And we can get that from an opponent next to us, say in a swim lane, but we can also get from the fans in the stands. In this instance, I think if we look back over the science of social psychology and sports psychology, we'll probably find that athletes that are less experienced actually will benefit because there'll actually be less social stress there because it is quiet. What we could think is elite athletes might not have their very best performances because elite athletes really thrive in that setting. That said, though, if we're watching the Olympics recently, there's been a lot of world records set. So I've got to think they were incredibly well prepared.
So you're saying for athletes who are less well known, maybe underdogs, not having a crowd might level the playing field a bit.
Exactly. I think the science has really kind of suggested that over the years because the energy can turn into anxiety quite quickly from a performance standpoint, as opposed to being that bump that, you know, that world-class athlete is used to and they probably thrive off of.
Is there a difference between sports that compete for time or distance, like a strict metric, as opposed to sports that compete for qualitative performance, like diving or gymnastics?
None of the activities are built the same. There's, you know, you've got your team sports, you've got your individual, you've got your short bursts, you got your long bursts. When it comes to this idea of potentially an energy bump, from fans and spectators, the sport's missing that the most of the short distance ones. 100 meters, the short hurdle events, the short swimming events, those really benefit from a fan bump. Mm. You know, what was it? Marathon swimming was on last night. That's not going to get a fan bump in energy, frankly.
What about gymnastics and diving? I mean, that seems to get like a little lift from the fans.
I think it's that novice expert double-edged sword, because those are sports where it gets a fan bump, mm-hmm. but also if the bump is too high, we're not good at fine motor skills and holding postures. So those are really those sports where athletes have had to learn to regulate their emotions quite well so they can execute these complex tasks. So yes, there's the energy of the crowd, but it also has to be regulated so well, or you can't hold those postures or positions. Most people don't appreciate the regulation of stress that has to go on. You need the energy to be explosive, but you need the poise to hold postures both safely and artistically.
Adam, you've worked with athletes at this elite level. What advice would you have been giving them to prepare for something like this?
First, let's mentally prepare for all of the potential options, but also when we show up there, to really take that breath and accept the environment, right? Sometimes we try and fight against it or make it perfect, but accept, acknowledge, and then find the energy they need. There's so many different ways athletes can either pump up or calm down. But I think building out those skills and a little bit of a plan in advance is what we often end up doing. And then I'll always say at the end, you know, letting themselves celebrate in their performance, not just after their performance, because it is such a huge achievement for any human. It's something hopefully they don't take so seriously. They take it serious enough they can compete well, but they celebrate their accomplishment while playing.
Adam Naylor is a sports psychology consultant based in Boston. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In many parts of the country right now, home prices are way up and the rental market is tight. Refugees and asylum seekers in the U.S. are also dealing with that tight market. Many are struggling to find an affordable place to live. Take the state of Maine. Reporter Ari Snyder spoke with recent and not-so-recent arrivals in Maine about their housing struggles. He has our story.
Rui Pirish is driving around Portland, Maine, and chatting with a friend on the phone. He's delivering groceries as a volunteer for the Angolan community of Maine. Pirish is from Luanda, the capital city of Angola, and came to Maine in 2019 to seek asylum with his son, Rumeri, now 10 years old. The two now live in Portland's East End, a mostly residential neighborhood close to downtown with easy access to parks, schools, and public transportation. Speaking in Portuguese, Pires says it's good to live in town, adding that he's near other Angolans and can keep up with what's going on in the community. But Pires says he may soon have to leave Portland. He says he recently secured his work permit after the mandatory waiting period for asylum seekers. Once he finds a job, Pires says, he'll no longer qualify for state housing assistance and likely won't be able to afford the nearly $2,000 per month rent for his current apartment. Pires is one of many asylum seekers who arrived in 2019, mainly from Angola and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who are now looking for long-term housing in a brutal real estate market. It's enough to keep Siona and Guizani very, very busy.
We say we need people in Maine, but so people cannot come if you don't have the housing situation.
Guizani works for the town of Brunswick, about 20 miles up the coast from Portland. Guizani, himself an asylee from Angola, coordinates all manner of assistance to several dozen asylum-seeking families in the area. Guizani says he's trying to help as many families as possible stay in Brunswick, but he has a hard time imagining how a single mother with three kids, for example, would be able to afford an apartment in the area.
It could be something around 1,600 a month. Would a mom be capable to cover that?
There's just a general shortage of affordable housing at the national level.
Krish Omara Vignaraja is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, a national organization that works with partner groups to resettle refugees all over the country. Vignaraja says they have historically resettled new arrivals in cities where the cost of living is relatively low. But, she says, many of these same places have become less affordable during the pandemic as remote workers have flocked to previously under-the-radar towns. Maine is no exception. A new report from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition shows Maine's affordable housing shortage has gotten worse over the past year. Meanwhile, home prices are up nearly 30% compared to this time last year. Given these daunting circumstances, some groups are getting creative.
There you go.
In Hollowell, a small river town in central Maine, a group called the Capital Area New Mainers Project is converting a former church into a 6-bedroom apartment for a Syrian refugee family. Speaking in a little annex room off the church's sanctuary, the group's co-founder, Hassan Al-Khafaji, says demand for affordable rental units is far outpacing supply.
Because the community is growing up. We have more people moved from another state, plus the immigrants who's coming from overseas, and we don't see any new buildings around.
While the church renovation will provide housing to one family, many others are still on their own. Abdelrahman Riyad, originally from Syria, moved to Maine in 2019 with 12 other members of his family. Another family took them in while they searched for housing, fitting a total of 25 people into a 6-bedroom home.
We was Sabrina and us, men sleeping like in the living room and the floor, and women sleeping in the rooms, you know.
After about 6 months, Riyad moved into an apartment with his mother and one of his brothers, but his housing struggles continue. He just recently got married.
We need to have like 3 bedrooms, one for my mom, one for my brother, one for me, you know, and there's nothing.
Riyad has company down the road in Portland, where Rui Pietish is also facing an extremely tight rental market. As he continues his volunteer food delivery route, Pietish says he wants to find a place close to his current apartment in the East End so his son doesn't have to switch schools again.
Yeah, então eu gostaria mesmo de estar aqui nessas proximidades.
Pietish doesn't know exactly when his housing assistance will end and he'll need to find a new place. But, he says, it's going to be soon. For The World, I'm Ari Snyder in Portland, Maine.
1 year ago today, a massive blast tore through the port of Beirut, one of the largest non-nuclear explosions ever recorded. More than 200 people were killed. Thousands more were injured. A year on, no one has been held responsible, while victims of the blast and their families continue to call for justice. Rebecca Collard reports from Beirut that few are hopeful.
This is the picture, look.
On her cell phone, Bernadette Jamail shows me a photo of the moment everything changed.
This is the port. Wow. You saw the smoke and the little fire into the smoke.
It's a photo she took of Beirut's port from her balcony on August 4th, 2020.
1 second before the explosion, I was standing here, this is my balcony.
Jamail goes over in detail everything that happened that day. All the little coincidences that led her whole family to be home at that moment, on that day, in their apartment facing Beirut's port. Her husband Jack should have been at work, but came home because the carpenter called unexpectedly, saying he wanted to come install their children's new bedroom set.
We wanted to be a special day, so that's why I brought a swimming pool for the kids. We began to inflate it with my little girl. So we're planning to be that it would be the, if you want, the happiest day for the kids.
Her husband came to the balcony to see the smoke. He showed the children the massive grain silos that dominate the skyline above the port.
He told them, don't be afraid, that there is a storage for the wheat and corn and for the rice. So don't be afraid, that is nothing important.
And he went inside to help the carpenter. Seconds later, the blast ripped through the city and her apartment. Jamail lost almost everything, her home, her place of employment, and her husband. A year later, Jamail and the families of the other more than 200 victims are still without answers and no closer to justice.
All the government are responsible. They all knew about the nitrate, okay? They all knew, all of them.
Over the past year, the families of the victims have been holding protests outside the homes of ministers and judicial offices. They march holding photos of their deceased loved ones and demanding justice. In this video, they are gathered outside the home of the Minister of the Interior, shouting that he is a terrorist. They haven't got that justice, but one thing is clear. Many of Lebanon's political elites, including the prime minister and the president, knew there were thousands of tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate in Beirut's port, next to a densely populated residential neighborhood, but they did nothing about it. What's still not clear is why it was being held in the port and what sparked the explosion. Rida Frangia is with Legal Agenda, a Lebanese rights organization.
So it's very clear to us that the ruling political parties in Lebanon are trying to sabotage the investigation and to derail efforts to find justice for the blast victims.
Lebanon has exceptional levels of immunity for ministers, members of parliament, and government employees, making it difficult for the judge to call key witnesses and suspects for questioning.
You have to understand that there was very little accountability in Lebanon for senior officials. No accountability whatsoever for their war crimes during the 80s, and no accountability for the widespread corruption and for the financial and economic collapse that we are now facing.
In fact, almost none of Lebanon's warlords have been tried for their crimes during Lebanon's civil war. And despite billions of dollars disappearing from public coffers, no senior officials have been convicted of that either. Frangia hopes this moment could be a turning point.
And what we hope is that because of the large-scale destruction caused by the blast, that this could be a real turning point for the country towards building a more democratic and fair system where rulers are held accountable for their crimes.
In recent weeks, there have been increasing calls for Parliament to remove immunity for those suspected of involvement in the blast. Some say Parliament doesn't want to do that because it could set a precedent that could see leaders and officials held accountable for decades of corruption and crimes.
I've sent you pictures for my husband.
Let's see. Oh, wow. Oh, is this him here? Yes. Bernadette Jamail shows me a cabinet with about a dozen photos of her husband. Happier days, their wedding, holidays, and family vacations.
My husband, the last sentence he said, "Don't be afraid, my kids."
Jamail says her family has paid the highest price for the corruption, incompetence, and negligence of the Lebanese government.
I paid too much. I paid blood. We paid blood in my families.
Jamail has no faith in a Lebanese investigation, no faith in the country's leaders or justice system.
Here in Lebanon, there is no justice. I don't believe in justice. No justice for the victims.
She says you can't ask suspects to investigate themselves.
Because all the government are guilty, so someone who's guilty can't find the truth. Someone who's guilty can't give the justice to people.
That has led to calls for the UN Human Rights Council to initiate an international investigation. It wouldn't be the criminal trial that so many here want, but it could get Lebanon closer to the truth. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Read more about Beirut 1 year later and the many unanswered questions around the blast. Come to our website, theworld.org. Jazz multi-instrumentalist and composer Mehmet Ali Sanlikol has a new album out, An Elegant Ritual. After many years leading large ensembles, this is the first outing in a trio for the Grammy-nominated Turkish-American composer. The sound is deep and complex, but everything was performed live by Sanlikol and his two collaborators, with no overdubbing. Sanlikol modeled An Elegant Ritual on the structure of two seemingly different influences, Turkey's Whirling Dervishes and John Coltrane's seminal composition, A Love Supreme. Stick with me here. The music that dancing dervishes spin to typically starts with an opening call to the dancers, followed by three other pieces. That just so happens to be a very similar structure to the four movements in Coltrane's A Love Supreme, which had a big impact on Sanlikol and many students of jazz. We close today with more of Mehmet Ali Sanlikol's composition, Hasret. This is the final movement in his work, and it's the final piece of our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're at theworld.org when we're not in your ears. Thank you for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.